Welcome to Holden Village. Today in the Fireside Room, the speaker is Fred Nieder, and he will be speaking on Overturning Parables, The Searching Judge, based on Matthew 25. So let's listen in on Fred Nieder.
I am just coming off of a sabbatical leave on which I've been working on a project that I've been doing for some time, including 2 years ago up here at Holden. And I've called the project in a general sort of way, Handling the Bible's Hatreds. And I have just completed the first draft of a manuscript on this, and I'll try to introduce briefly what I mean by the Bible's hatreds and why we need to, quote, handle them. There's a great deal of leftover animosity and enmity and plain accursiveness that is left in the Bible from the historical periods in which it was written. And every once in a while we bump into it. Most of it has been cut out of the lectionary that we mostly hear the Bible read in our worship services. For example, a whole lot of the Psalms in the Old Testament or the Hebrew Bible have sections in them toward the end, usually, in which the psalmist launches into condemnation of our enemies and so forth. And most of those psalms have been excised, and you won't find them in the LBW. The most famous example, I suppose, is Psalm 137, which starts out as a very poignant psalm, lamenting the loss of Jerusalem, and the psalmist goes on about how could we possibly sing the songs of Zion in this strange place, so we've hung up our lyre on the tree limbs and so forth, and we will not sing. And then all of a sudden it switches to, O Lord, have at the Edomites and make sure that their babies get their heads smashed on the rocks. Which is left over from the days, of course, at the end of the Babylonian siege of Jerusalem, when the Edomites apparently, instead of helping their neighbors, the people of Jerusalem, they either did nothing or they in fact collaborated with the Babylonians. And so forever, the Israelites, the Jews, hate the Edomites. But there are a whole lot of other psalms like that express hatred of either various groups or in general our enemies. Most of them are not in the OVW, but I'll never forget one time a couple years ago at my home church, Psalm 139 was the psalm of the day, and we were singing out of the LBW, and I forgot what Sunday of the church year it is, but you get up to a certain point in Psalm 139, like verses 1 to 14, and then you skip to verse 19, you know, like they do sometimes. Well, the congregation was singing along, and everybody forgot that you're supposed to jump from verse 14 to verse 19 or whatever it is, and all of a sudden we hear ourselves singing, something about, oh, we hate our enemy, hate your enemies, oh God, with a perfect hatred, we loathe them. It sort of all of a sudden chokes your mouth. Of course, there's eternal condemnations of other peoples as well in the Bible, the Moabites, for example, as well as the Edomites, can never have any part in the temple or in the assembly, according to the book of Deuteronomy, and then it's reinforced by Ezra and Nehemiah. Well, there are similar things in the New Testament. Of course, anybody who grew up like I did hearing Bible stories automatically thinks of Pharisees as just terrible people, enemies of Jesus and the Christians in every conceivable way, and to some extent perpetrators of Jesus' death. And so, you know, Judaism is an outgrowth of, current Judaism is an outgrowth of the Pharisaic movement, so generations of Christians have used parts of the New Testament to maintain various attitudes, negative attitudes about Jews. There are a couple really vicious texts in the New Testament. Bible, my mind. In 2 Peter 2, the author takes after some so-called false prophets that are troubling the Christians of the author's audience. And at about verse 12, the author says, these people, these false prophets, are nothing but animals who have been born purely for the purpose of being hunted down and killed. And that's a hard saying. The people, the audience of 2 Peter was likely enduring at least some persecution. They were being hunted down like animals and killed. But it almost sounds like the venomous spirit of the persecutors has infected the Christian community, and they have begun to talk in this same way finally, that these other human beings who are their enemies have been born just as animals to be hunted down and killed. And so it's kind of hard to imagine that this is the spirit of the loving God at work here. So I've been struggling with these kinds of texts and stories, which both condemn and dehumanize other human beings in some sort of a permanent or dastardly way, or which polarize the Christian community from everybody else in certain unhealthy ways. And I've been working on this for several years, and I'm going to do a couple things tonight and tomorrow afternoon that are part of some of my more recent work on this. One other thing about this generally, we might think that these old hatreds against ancient people, I mean, I don't know any Edomites. I know that there are Edomites around because there are the descendants of those people still among what today we call the Palestinians. But there aren't any Edomites in particular to go after these days, so maybe we would think that's all harmless. But I don't know how many of you know the full story of things like the Hebron massacre last February over in the Middle East. This fellow named Baruch Goldstein, an American-born and trained medical doctor, went to the mosque at Hebron, and just as the prayers began, he shot up the whole place and killed all these people. Well, what most people didn't realize was that that happened on the Jewish Feast of Purim, which is the festival in which the Jews celebrate the defeat of their enemies, and that the way, or a major piece of celebrating the Feast of Purim, is to read the Book of Ruth, and in fact to act it out as a melodrama. In some congregations is the tradition, the children will act out this story and have noisemakers and so on, and when the wicked Haman comes on the scene, they make their racket, and then they cheer for Mordecai or for Ruth or whoever. Well, that's Esther, I'm sorry. I've been saying Ruth this whole time. Esther. They act out the story of Esther. Well, Baruch Goldstein, on the night before he did this, on the eve of Purim, he sat and read the Book of Esther to his children. And the Book of Esther concludes with the Jews asking permission to go and slaughter all their enemies, and they get permission, and they do. And so basically what happened was that this man read a piece of the Bible and went and acted it out. You know, so these ancient stories have some power. And people still can find warrant in this book to do some terrible things. I sort of approach it as containers of, obviously the Bible is the source of our contact with with the gospel and with God's promises to the ancient people and the covenant and so forth. But the wars and the hatred that affected these people in ancient times crept into their stories as well, and they're kind of like containers of ancient poison, which can every once in a while get opened up, like they did with poor old Baruch Goldstein, and a whole lot of people suffer for these ancient hatreds kept bottled up. Well, the story we're going to look at tonight is qualifies for study in this group only because it is a kind of text which polarizes the human race about as clearly as you can polarize the human race. And it's Matthew 25, not the beginning, but I think it's verse 35 and following, the story of the last judgment, or the parable of the last judgment. Excuse me, 31. I once heard somebody say that there are two kinds of people in the world. There are those who split the world up into two kinds of people and those who don't. I started out my life among the people who did split the world up into two kinds of people. And I suppose like a whole lot of you who grew up in and around the Cold War and so forth, and we divided the world up between the free world and the Iron Curtain, imprisoned people, and the godless communists and the Christian West and so forth. And I have all kinds of stories about what that was like, which I will spare you. Children in my town had a little card with the silhouettes of Russian or Soviet aircraft on one side and American aircraft on the other. And we were supposed to watch the skies looking for communist aircraft. And if we ever saw one, there was a number to call. This was near the Strategic Air Command base in Nebraska. That's where I grew up. So we were always looking for airplanes. It was a scary world, a world full of enemies. But it wasn't just politics, it was religion too. I grew up in a town that was strictly Catholics and Lutherans. And both groups were totally convinced that the other were going to hell. And I knew parents that didn't go to their own children's weddings because they were held in the other church. And it was a spooky thing to play in the summertime with the children who were going to hell. And then they would go off to Catholic school in the fall in the daytime, and we'd to the Lutheran school to learn again where all our friends we played with all summer were going. Both groups were doing it. It wasn't just the Lutherans. Buried suicides in separate sections of the cemetery, if at all, in the church cemetery, and so forth. So we didn't even want to sleep in the dirt with the damned. We didn't want to get too close to them. So it was really a world full of them and us, the saved and the damned. Well, no story in the Bible is quite as clear about the saved and the damned and polarizes the human race, to me anyway, as cleanly and clearly as Matthew 25, verses 31 and following. And I don't know that we need to read the whole thing. It's repetitive to a certain extent for effect. I think we can summarize it here quickly and make the necessary points. Come on in. We're through the introduction. We're going to start on Matthew 25, 31 and following. Note, please, that it's the parable about the Son of Man who comes in his glory and all the angels with him, and he will sit on the throne of his glory. All the nations will be gathered before him, and he'll separate people as from one from another, as a shepherd separates sheep from the goats, and put the sheep at the right hand, goats at the left. The king will say to those on the right, "Come, you that are blessed by my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me something to drink. A stranger, and you welcomed me," and so on. And the righteous, verse 37, said, "Well, Lord, when was this?" "We don't remember." And he said, "Truly, I tell you," verse 40, "just as you did it to one of the least of these who are," the older translations say, "my brothers," some of them say "my brothers and sisters," this NRSV says "family," "you did it to me." And to the left, "you're cursed, depart from me. I was hungry and you gave me nothing, and stranger, and you didn't welcome me," and so forth. And they too say, "Lord, when was this? We don't remember." And he says, "Truly, I tell you, as you did not do it to one of the least of these, you didn't do it to me." And these will go away into an eternal punishment, but the righteous into eternal life. By the way, we're not supposed to look at verse 41 too careful about eternal fire. Janet Grant has to. No, I'm just kidding. We're not supposed to say scary things about fire. Sorry, bad joke. Okay, I'm sure that's familiar to virtually everybody here. This is a very common parable. It's in the lectionary of ILCW that the Lutherans use on at least one occasion that I know of, and that's Christ the King Sunday, the last Sunday of the church year, in Cycle A. But it's a story, I'm sure, that most all of you have known most of your life. I don't know, is this a troubling parable to anybody for other reasons than I might be bringing up? Or are there things about this that have always been curious or questionable to you before I get going here?
When I really examine my life, I'm not sure which side I'll be on. Because I'm not sure how much of this meaning is about the purpose of the meaning.
Yeah, it's one of those sets of criteria that leave you wondering how much is enough. If I did this once, is that enough? You know? And what if I missed somebody once? Where exactly would you draw the line? The way it sounds, you could read it to say, if even one time you did this, you qualify. You know, you're in.
What category?
Well, that's the question, you know, you could ask that too. Do you have to have at least one naked, at least one stranger, at least one prisoner?
Yeah, right.
So everybody's got their checklist. Okay, well, I got my prisoner.
That's over with.
That's right.
I got my prisoner, I can move on to a naked prison.
A scavenger hunt for good deeds.
Pardon?
A scavenger hunt for good deeds.
Yeah. It could look like that.
If you start to do that, it's never enough for the person that's driven that way. I learned to be these things. It's never enough.
Well, Lutherans have problems with this because it seems as though Jesus is advocating that good works save us.
Absolutely. Notice Jesus does not, or the Son of Man does not say, "Are you a Lutheran?"
Or even, "Are you Christian?"
Are you Christian?
All the nations.
Or do you believe?
Anybody who would do these things supposedly gets saved, and that's kind of troublesome for folk.
It's like the end of the Athanasian Creed.
Yeah.
get that part.
Oh, yeah.
He's still writing over there.
That's a little joke for those.
Well, isn't it kind of like when we're supposed to forgive 70 times 7? I mean, I guess it's when the opportunity is there, or even we can seek out opportunities. But faith without work, you can't say you have faith if you're not going to do anything to show that faith.
And clearly Matthew, I mean, this appears in Matthew, and only in Matthew. And that's one of Matthew's concerns, that empty words, the right words, empty, aren't enough. Partly for this very reason that Mike brought up, this was a comforting parable to me at a certain point in my life when I got all confused in my late college and early seminary days and wasn't quite sure how everything fit together anymore. I was really glad that Jesus didn't ask, now do you really truly understand the Athanasian Creed? Have you got the doctrine of the real presence completely sorted out? Or the communicatio idiomaticum, or all these other technical things that they were trying to teach us in seminary? So I was just glad that this was the criteria, and I picked up a lot of hitchhikers in those days. Because I wanted to be ready. Yeah, so that's something to think about, that what this parable says we get judged on as human beings for the life we lived was plain and simple, how we treated those who were, in comparison to us, little, the small, the weak, the needy, whatever. So this is probably in many ways more sobering than it is comforting in some senses. Well, I've been playing with this parable. What I'm going to do next is not what I'm claiming is the way the parable is supposed to be read in some definitive way, but I'm going to try to take you through, I guess adventure is too big of a word, but an experience of sort of tinkering with the biblical text and see how it might look if you did some little bit different things with it once, that the text itself will at least partly warrant. See, the end of this afternoon, this was happening to the speaker too. You're getting sense of what's being driven from the
ass. Well, part of the reason is that I don't
know. And then why aren't they bugging?
Oh.
Just blowing right by.
The judge is a clue to something that I want to think about with you together. The judge in the parable is the Son of Man. And we are accustomed to thinking about the Son of Man, most of us anyway, from all the stories we've heard as children and whatnot, as just a way of Jesus talking about himself. And some of the Son of Man sayings in the New Testament are just that. There are ways that Jesus seems to talk about himself in this curious third-person manner. He says, the foxes have holes and the birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man doesn't even have a place to lay his head. And he seems just to be talking about himself and his own lifestyle. But there are other sayings in which Jesus and Jesus is the only person who ever uses this phrase in the New Testament. This is never a phrase that the narrator uses. It's not a phrase used elsewhere in the New Testament. It's strictly an expression on Jesus' own lips in the Gospels. And sometimes when he refers to whoever this Son of Man is, it's it's in descriptions of a judge who will at the end of things or whatever preside over the judgment scene of everybody in the world. For example, in Mark and Matthew, at the crucial moment of the trial of Jesus, the high priest asks him, "Are you the Christ?" And Jesus says, "I am." And then he goes on to say, "And you will see the Son of Man coming," it's a little different in each case, but coming to judge the world. So that's a little different kind of picture than just Jesus using Son of Man as a way to talk about himself in the third person. This is as though this is some other figure. This is the judge who will come, you know. And yes, we say in Christian tradition that this judge who will come will be Jesus, the risen Christ, who will preside over the judgment of the world. And we get that picture very clearly drawn in books like Revelation. But the background of this term, Son of Man, is exceedingly complicated in the Bible. It's all over the place in certain sections of the Old Testament. The most common place is in the book of Ezekiel, because the book of Ezekiel uses that phrase as the way God addresses the prophet. Son of Man, go do this. Son of Man, go do that. And the newest translations refer to that, or translate that expression as mortal. Mortal, as opposed to divine being or whatever, go do this, go do that, whatever. So it's understood there to be some sort of distinction between God and the human prophet. It's an expression in a couple of Psalms that refer to the whole human race. In the book of Daniel, there in Daniel 7, there is a poem about the Ancient of Days handing over the responsibility for judging the world to one like a Son of Man. And then that person steps forward to do the work of judgment. A lot of debate about who that is in its original context. It's likely the people of Israel, the picked on people of the world, are finally going to be able to have a chance to be in judgment over the conquering empires of the world. That's a common reading. And so you could read the New Testament references in a similar sort of way. It must look like it's spastic.
Don't you read your Bible?
You could picture it that way, you know. Here the picked on person will finally get to judge the world. And what I'm going to suggest as a little bit different kind of reading maybe does have some of that flavor. This is not an original idea with me, but there is another way to understand a possible identity behind the whole figure of the Son of Man in the New Testament. I first heard this from a scholar named Wolfgang Roth, who teaches at Garrett Seminary in Chicago, where Peter Nash, the program director this summer, also teaches. There was an ancient Jewish teaching around in the era when the New Testament grew up, and about a century and a half or so before, that one of the ways God would respond to the problem of the Hellenistic and other empires prior to Jesus' time, wiping out Jewish people strictly for their faithfulness, in terrible, can read about in books like Maccabees, 2nd and 3rd and 4th Maccabees, have some of these descriptions of how they would take people and tie them up and insist that they eat pork. And if they wouldn't eat pork, they would, you know, open your mouth and accept a bite of pork, or we're going to torture you. And old Eliezer is the man whose story is told there. And they finally beat him to death and gouge out his eyes and everything else, you know, because he won't eat pork and defy the laws of God. Or they kill the seven sons of the same mother who also refused to take a bite of pork into their mouth and defy the law of God. Well, the Jews began to ask, how is God going to respond to the fact that we are being wiped out for our faithfulness? And the wicked, you know, live on prosperously and die happily in their beds at age 90 with their grandchildren standing around. Not every one of them, but what's the deal? Well, one of the stories that began to develop was that someday God would send back to the earth the first martyr whose blood had ever been shed for the way he worshiped God. And that first martyr would collect all the blood of all the martyrs. And the ancient Israelite and Jewish people believed that the life of a creature was in its blood. That's why they didn't eat blood. So that would be to collect all the lives of all the martyrs, collect all that blood, and return it to God. And then God would have the martyrs back. And so the martyrs would then be with God, and the wicked who killed them would just be dead. This was before any development of any teachings of, you know, a resurrection, like we think of. Well, who is the first martyr? Whoever died for the way he worshiped God.
Abel.
The first Christian.
Abel.
The first person who ever died because of the fight about religion was Abel. Turn back to Genesis 4. Let's look at that. It was a problem about religion. Abel was a keeper of sheep, and Cain was a tiller of the ground. We could spend an hour on this story too, if you want. You know there's going to be trouble. Just that story. That's right. The shepherds and the farmers, or the farmers and the ranchers. It just never has worked. Now, so you know there's going to be trouble from the beginning. But Cain brings an offering to the Lord. Now, nobody asked him to do that. Nobody commanded that. That's something Cain just up and did. Cain, as it were, invented worship or sacrifice. Abel, his little brother, he sees that, so he does too. He brings firstlings of his flock. The Lord had regard for Abel and his offering, but for Cain and his offering he had no regard. So Cain was angry and his countenance fell. Christian and Jewish history too is full of explanations which get God off the hook for this apparent unfairness. He would accept one offering and not the other. We read into these stories, well, there must have been something wrong with Cain's offering. The story doesn't say that. It just says they both offered stuff up and God accepted one, not the other, period. And Cain was angry. And why wouldn't he be? because we probably need to march fast and take no prisoners, what this likely means is that Cain was not prospering. His offerings and the purpose of them was not, it wasn't working. Abel, however, was receiving God's favor. And so Cain's angry. It's not fair. So he does what you do when you get mad at God, but you can't wring God's neck. I mean, he's not mad at Abel, right? It's God that he's angry with. Abel's got nothing to do with it. But if you can't wring God's neck, you do the next best thing. You wring God's pet's neck. Okay, God, you like him? I'll fix him. Take that, God. So Cain spoke to his brother. In the English Bibles, I'll say, let's go out into the field. And then most of them have a footnote that say that the Hebrew text lacks, let us go out into the field. The Hebrew text just says, Cain spoke to his brother, period. And when they were out in the field, Cain rose up against Abel and killed him. Then God comes, checks it out, and both in this story and in the previous story of the mess in the Garden of Eden, God is very interesting. If I were casting these in film, I would cast God, the character of God would be played by Peter Falk as in Columbo. Okay, now, where'd you say your brother was again? Run that past me again. Where was your brother? Just like within the garden, you know, God's walking around, he can't find the people. Where are you? We're in the bushes. We're hiding. We're naked. Now, what did you do? So God checks it out. And he speaks with Cain. And there's all kinds of interesting stuff here that we could look at. But look what God does. Your brother's blood is crying out to me from the ground, and now you are cursed from the ground, which has opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood. When you till the ground, it will no longer give you its strength. Cain says, that's too much. My punishment is greater than I can bear. Driven me away. Anyone who meets me will kill me. The Lord says, no, whoever kills Cain will suffer sevenfold vengeance. And so that no one would do this, he put a mark upon Cain so that no one would come and kill him. So he saves Cain thereby from what Cain has loosed in the earth, namely vengeance. Just like God makes clothes for the people in the previous story because of the nakedness and shame that they brought on themselves. And they look so dumb in those fig leaves. So God always has something to take care of the terrible thing that the humans have now unleashed into the earth. So, this is the first martyr who died over a dispute about religion. And his blood was shed in the earth. And his name is Abel, but as a Jew, his full name would be what? You guys will hear about Rocky Johnson here all.
Abel Bar Adam.
But yeah, he would be, well, that would be Aramaic. Yeah, he would be Abel Ben Adam. And this word means son of, and this word means son of man. He's the son of man, son of Adam, son of humankind in Hebrew. So, that's one of the things that's in the background somewhere of this term son of man in the New Testament. we're invited to think of the risen Christ as among so many other things, Abba ben Adam, the first martyr, the ultimate martyr, coming back to bring the blood of the faithful and back to God. But what if we take this guy himself, this Abba ben Adam, and put him in this parable? Okay? Let's let the character of Abel here. Let's flip back now to Matthew 25. What happens if you put Abel there? But before you do, before you get finished doing it, I want to share something else with you that is worth thinking about. One of the things that happened to me as I was working on this text one time was I was simultaneously teaching out of a book by Elie Wiesel, the Holocaust survivor who won the Nobel Prize winner, and so on. He's got a little book called Messengers of God, in which he does some wonderfully insightful studies of several biblical characters. He's got another similar book on a different group of biblical characters, and I tried to find Messengers of God here. They don't have one. I have an extra, so I'm going to send it to the library here. One of the characters that he studies, or one of the stories that he studies, is Cain and Abel. And in that study, Wiesel picks up on the fact that, as we noticed, when Cain was in his fight with God, he went and he spoke to his brother, and then there is this silence. And the next thing we find is these people are out in the field, and Cain kills his brother. Wiesel says, what do you suppose Cain said to Abel? Cain was hurting. Cain was angry enough so that God said, Cain, what's the matter with your face? Your countenance has fallen. Why are you so angry? Wiesel says, what if Cain went to Abel and said, I'm really hurting, man. You know, look what God is doing to me. Cain spoke to his brother. And what did Abel say? Nothing. I mean, granted, that's, we're moving beyond a truly simple kind of reading of these texts. So, Wiesel says that was how Abel was compliant in his own death. He was an accomplice because when your brother is hurting, your first responsibility is to him. Even when the pain that your brother is suffering has been inflicted by your common God. God can take care of God's self. Your first responsibility is to your brother or your sister. If someone suffers and it is not you, Wiesel says, your first responsibility is to them. Not that Cain gets off the hook here, because of course, Wiesel points out, being God's chosen one isn't easy either. In fact, that's harder, according to Wiesel. And Cain didn't understand that either. And so, these are two brothers that failed each other. So now, Abel, in Matthew 25, has his chance. He gets to be the judge of everybody in the world. And the criterion is, how did you treat
who?
Your brother.
Your little brother. So Abel, the little brother, gets to judge the world and find out how everybody treated the little brother. And his big brother is in the crowd, right? His brother didn't do so well by the little brother, right? So what's Abel going to do to his brother?
He's going to forgive him. No, I
don't know. Well, I mean, I'm going to leave that open for the moment. That's one character we can look at in this story. The judge. The judge is the Son of Man. Could be, in part, this first martyr character, this Abel ben Adam. That complicates the story. It gives it dimensions that raise all sorts of questions and possibilities. Well, the other characters in the story, obviously, are the sheep and the goats. A few years ago, when I went to preach on this text, I had a funny thing happen to me. I still don't know exactly why this happened, but I got to thinking about, it was actually about a single individual that I knew. She has since died. I called her the Mother Teresa of Valparaiso. And I got, for some reason, I pictured her in this scene. Over there with the sheep. And it suddenly occurred to me that in that moment, which she's over there, and here's all these goats over here, and the Son of Man says, all right, off with you to the fire, and oh, blessed are you, here's your reward now. And she's looking over there. What do you suppose, do you know people like that? People who do these things, not because it's in the Bible, because that's what they do. It wouldn't occur to them not to do those things. Imagine those people who you know in this story. Put them over there with the sheep. And listen to them in your heart once. The ones I know would say, wait! What are you doing? We're not done yet. You know? Because those people are the ones they've been working on.
That's right. That's right.
You know, naked in their meanness and hungry in their human emptiness because they just haven't got it yet about what it means to be a human being. And here the sheep has been working on this and now the Son of Man is okay, to the fire. Yeah, so I pictured them talking to the Son of Man. And of course, since this is the last judgment, the Son of Man has to say, well, I'm sorry, but you're out of time. You are a creature. You are creatures of time. I'll try to just ignore it. You are creatures of time. You know, you human beings, you can't go back. You can't go back. You can't go for them. Then what would they say? What would you say?
But you can change that because you're God.
Well, you can go. So you won't let us go? So you go. Besides, your brother's over there and he's got that mark on him. Remember that mark? The mark says vengeance isn't the answer, little brother. Vengeance is not the solution to the problem. So in my reading of the parable, the Son of Man, especially if Christ is in here, I mean, what's Christ going to say? Except, Jesus, I tell you to talk like that. You're using my best lines on me. So the reason I call this little play with this parable the searching judge is because I picture the sheep begging the shepherd who's dividing the sheep and the goats. Jesus, the good shepherd, Abel, the shepherd, first martyr, begging that one to go after the ones that they ran out of time on. I figure he went, or that he's still going. The way I find room for that in the larger framework of Christian theology is by remembering what we say every time we repeat the Apostles' Creed, that he descended into hell. That he left the bounds of space and time. And Luther said a lot of things about that. He said a lot of things about hell. In fact, one time he said there is no such thing as hell because God doesn't need it yet. It won't be necessary till the last judgment. And so if God still needs it, when the time of the last judgment comes in, God will make it. But Luther always contradicted himself. So he also once said, if there's a hell, it's empty because no one's been put there. But he also said that the fact that Jesus descended into hell means that there is no place I can go except that even there he is Lord for me. Much of the background, such as it is in the scriptures for that creed, or that line getting into the creed, is in 1 Peter chapter 3. I'm going to look at it for a minute. Verses 18 and following. For Christ also suffered for sins once for all, the righteous for the unrighteous, in order to bring you to God. He was put to death in the flesh, but made alive in the spirit, in which he also went and made a proclamation to the spirits in prison, who in former times did not obey, whom God waited patiently in the days of Noah, during the building of the ark, in which a few, that is, eight persons, were saved through water. Okay, so who did Jesus go and preach to after he was dead in the flesh but alive in the spirit? The people in prison who blew it in the days of Noah and got wiped away in the great judgment, in which one group was saved and the other was lost. Reformationary theologians used to argue about, well, what did Jesus say when he went to preach to the spirits in prison? If Jesus went to hell to preach, what would he say? And then the one group, the Calvinists in particular, they said Jesus would go there and say, you guys lost, live with it, or not. Luther said, gospel has one purpose, to invite people into God's grace. which means evidently that though we might not have a chance at reconciling with people or getting them back or however it is, or reconciling to ourselves or reconciling to God within the bounds of space and time, God has God's ways beyond the bounds of space and time. That's what the descent to hell can be understood to mean. And I think because of some, I mean, I've done a lot of work in Matthew, and I believe that Matthew would affirm that, that humans fail at the work of forgiveness and reconciliation with themselves and with others and with God, but that God doesn't let that be the end of the possibilities. Yeah, you don't get your life back on this earth, you can waste it. You can be a person who never once gives a little person a cold drink. You can just never get what it means to a human being and never get another chance. But that doesn't necessarily mean anything. Well, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to talk so long. The end. Discussion, responses, questions?
Well, what makes that parable of the sheep and goats troublesome for me is that it follows the parable of talents and the parable of ten virgins, with ten virgins which are equally harsh to me.
Yeah.
Three in a row, I think. Triple whammy. Yeah. It does not sound like the God that revealed in Christ. The embracing, giving God.
Like the virgins who had the oil should have shared.
Yeah, and those who don't have even what he has, what they do have will be taken from them. You know, and kick them out into darkness where they'll be weeping and gnashing their teeth.
Matthew is full of that. Weeping and gnashing of teeth occurs. It's either nine or it's about nine times things end up with it. And then they go off into the outer darkness where there's weeping and gnashing of teeth. Matthew plays hardball.
Well, even the last verse of this one, that they will go away to eternal punishment.
But the way I read the parable, the way I just played with the parable, Son of Man goes well.
Just to play devil's advocate, the first, in the second verse of the next chapter, though, you know, as you know, the Passover is 2 days away, and the Son of Man will be handed over to be crucified. So it's falling right on the tails of that parable.
And he will now become the martyr, obviously.
I think one of the dangers of parable, any parable, and particularly these last three parables in Matthew 25, but the one on the last judgment, is that we often don't read it as a parable, but we read it as an allegory. And I think one of the helpful things you're doing, Fred, is whether we may agree with everything or not that you're saying, I think you're pulling us back and saying, well, if we say this is a parable, then let's take it seriously again as a parable, and not like an allegory, as though this gives us some kind of map or scale model about what the end of the world is exactly going to be like. But this is a parable. And if it's a parable, then it has to fit in with all the other parables, where the point of parables are somehow telling us about God's reign and rule and how grace works. And so at least, again, you're putting us in the right direction, because somehow you're trying to struggle with this parable and say, now what's Jesus trying to tell me about how grace works? And I think that's something that I appreciate, right? I mean, that's something we need to struggle with again. How is grace working in this parable? Because that's what parables are about. Allegories might be about all sorts of other things, but I don't think we're working with allegory.
And down the way of allegory is always deciding, all right, well, who are these people?
Right.
If this is the map,